There it is.
Well, thanks for coming on a snowy night. Yes.
I'm sorry, do you have to pre-register for that or just show up?
No, it's free.
Show up.
It's just free, just show up, yeah.
Thank you.
And the parking's, you know, inexpensive. It's just right there. Well, tonight we begin answering the tough question of evolution, but not by arguing against the science. That is not a smart strategy for people of faith. Even if you are a scientist, you'd be in such a there'd just be such a minority of you, and evolution in particular has just taken over, the same way Big Bang has taken over, the same way fine-tuning has taken over. So you don't want to take on an army of millions of biologists to defend faith. Bad strategy. You'll lose. And we don't want to lose. You know, way back, I think it was in the early 400s, St. Augustine was talking about something very similar. And he said he comes upon Christians all the time who are trying to defend the faith by arguing against the science and trying to defend, in his case, he was talking about the literal order that's in Genesis chapter 1. And he said, when you do that, if you run into someone who actually knows something about that, you're going to tell them that, well, what you're doing is so off base that they're not going to be interested in it. Our job, everybody's job, this is from St. John Paul II, is to be an evangelist. And to be an evangelist requires in our time, the tools of our time, including reason. And what's the primary reason of our time? It's scientific reason. So you don't want to get in the way of that, because you will lose, and also because you don't want to argue against something that's true. And you know, it's like when Gamaliel, you remember the Rabbi Gamaliel in Book of Acts? Anybody remember that story?
Yeah, but what did he do?
What did he do? Oh, Jane, they were about to kill most of the, you got it now? All right, holler it out, Jane. Go ahead.
What if he's right? Basically, what he said, we don't want to kill this guy because what if he's right? I think it's the summary.
Yeah, it was the apostles. They said, if these guys are wrong, it'll die out in a year or two. It'll be a fad. It'll be over.
Yep.
But if they're on the side of God, we of all people don't want to be fighting against what's on the side of God. Mm-hmm. Now that's the risks that we face here, guys. A lot is at stake in this. So one of the things you always want to do when you're doing theology and when you're defending the faith is, first of all, don't say anything wrong. Sort of like a doctor, first do no harm. And then try to do something really positive and helpful. All right, so let's review from where we've been, from especially from last week. This is our fourth session. We'll do last week and a few leftovers. Even before last week, in the first week and in the second week, we did the history of Catholic scientists, cardinals, bishops, priests, who did such great work for over 1,000 years. So we put to bed the myth, the falsehood, that the church and science have always been in conflict. Just a false story. And I think you figured that one out in the first 5 or 10 minutes. And the second is that scientists have come up with a story. It's not just a story, it's a story that's backed by more evidence than almost any other theory, which is Big Bang, about how the universe began. And in the beginning of the Big Bang, it's not just stuff, it's not just matter. It's matter, it's energy, it's time, and it's space. All of them begin together. It's a very unusual beginning. And it was a very unusual explosion because stuff didn't explode. The space itself was stretched. And it still is being stretched. That's the theory, and it all does fit with Einstein's equations that he did, including the famous E equal mc squared, but all the other ones as well. Okay, so that background was terribly important before we got into evolution, because as it turns out, Big Bang is like the best gift science could give theology and faith. I mean, it's like, if you're an atheist, that's a problem. If you believe that God created the heavens and the earth, it's a gift, a big gift, a tremendous assist. And a lot of the scientists, when it was first proven, they squealed like stuck pigs because they just didn't want the universe to have a beginning. Because if a universe has a beginning, the next question is, yeah, how did it begin? And why was it orderly when it began? Why wasn't it just immediately chaotic? It wasn't. It was a very, very ordered explosion. It was a very, very ordered beginning. All right, so that's just to review our first and second sessions. And then last week we did the hardest work of all that's behind us now, which is the challenges of evolution. And tonight our job is to answer those challenges, at least to begin to. So there's four that we're primarily working on. We'll take on the first two, and then in our next two sessions, after Holy Week, we'll take Holy Week off next week, and then the two following weeks, we'll finish up with the last two. So we're on offense now. Last week was just defense. Now, remember Thomas Aquinas' thing, he puts the objections first, then he has a pivot, and then he gives his own answer. We're beginning to give our own answer tonight. All right, now we're getting oriented. Creation has creative beauty. When you think of creation, most of us typically think of a far away, one-time event where it's kind of vague, but God somehow far, far away did something, and then there was creation. Actually, I think there's some truth in that. That's one of the ways we want to keep that idea of creation. But there's a second idea. It's called continuing creation. And this creation says that creation never stops being creative, and that's where we live. And this, you see now, is an additional form of grace. It's a gift to us, because now we are participants in the creativity of creation. And that is what I'm trying to show you that evolution can do. This is the beginning of how we take the challenge and turn it to our own advantage. So the object of the game here is not to play for a tie. Trying to show how evolution actually gives us a superior understanding of creation. See, the Apostle Paul didn't know anything about cell biology. The Apostle Paul was inspired by God. Peter and James and John were inspired, but they didn't know anything about cosmology, and they didn't know anything about the very, very tiny stuff. This is all new, expanded stuff. This is a gift that science has given us. Now, you remember last week we ended with my favorite parable. Do you remember which one?
The
parable of the talents, right. And what was one of the points that we took away from that? Just all around something you got from the talents. Tommy, are you taking questions tonight? You know, sometimes politicians will come out and say, no questions. You know the parable?
Yeah.
Okay, so what was the positive point? There's three servants. Okay, the first two servants get rewarded. Why did they get rewarded?
They invested.
They invested wisely and they worked at it and they took what they've been given and they developed it. And they actually doubled it. And then the third servant, who got punished severely, tried to give, he tried to give the one talent back to the master. He said, here it is, just the way you gave it to me. Master said, no way. So there's an implied command of Christ in the parable that we're to take what we've been given and develop it. Now, my theory is that modern day science is a new gift that we are charged to develop. So that's our sacred task. It's not just let's see if we can do something that's intellectually clever or something like that. This is actually how we can strengthen faith and how we can explain it to our own family and explain it to people who are doubting it as well. Okay, so now think about the beauty of the story that the army of evolutionary biologists are telling. It starts with a single-celled bacterium. Now, if you can go from a single-celled bacterium to the people sitting in this room, that's an amazing development. It's a physical development, but it's still amazing, and it's full of beauty. Second point, creation by divine logos. Remember on the first session, in the beginning was the logos, and the logos was with God, and the logos was God, and everything that was made through the logos. The logos is imprinted in all reality, so that all reality is lawful. It has pattern, it has order. Even the disorder is part of the pattern. And there's a special kind of logos that is the human mind. So there's a logos inside the human mind, and there's a logos inside the fabric of things. And that logos is the reason that there is reason. It's your very ability to think. So we don't always get it right. I certainly don't. But when we do get it right, it's because the logos inside the mind is making a contact with the logos inside the fabric of things. Then remember our distinction of fact, hypothesis, and theory. And theory is way, way more than a hypothesis. It's good to have a hypothesis, but you always have to have more than facts, because you got to organize your facts. Otherwise, you just be outside counting snowflakes. If you have no way to organize things. So some things are more important than others, and that principle of selectivity is crucial. That's what a theory does. It teaches you how to be selective. Then I wanted to remind you that John Paul II recognizes evolution as a viable theory, as a confirmed theory. And he also, when he called together all the biologists for an entire summer meeting in Rome at the Vatican Academy of Sciences, he blessed the biologists. He blessed them and he blessed their work. So we don't want to fight that. We want to be on side. We want to help that. We don't want to oppose that. Now, a couple of other points about evolution. This is one I don't think I made very well last week, but let me make it now. Evolution tinkers. It doesn't build like with a perfect design in mind. It tinkers until it gets it right. And when it gets it right for a little while, and then the situation changes, and then it keeps tinkering. So, you remember the Apollo 13 spacecraft? And they got in big trouble. Okay. Great book, great movie, great event. All right, so they're in trouble, and they're up in space. They're thousands and thousands of miles away. I mean, they're in real trouble. They're really right at the edge of death. And so what did they do? They tinkered. They tinkered with what they had, and they built stuff with what they have. Now that's an analogy to evolution. The disanalogy is that they were using their minds, they were using logos. And in the actual physical evolution, it's not thinking. It's not working it out through. It's not planning itself. Rabbits don't plan how they're going to get better. They just, one of them just runs faster and then tends to have more offspring, and that spreads through the population. Okay, then that brings us to our next point, which is the evolution of evolution. That's us. Now this happens in two important ways. First, human culture. So for instance, my grandfather, whom I never met, died of pneumonia when he was, I think, 29 years old. I think there were millions or so in America who died of pneumonia. I've had pneumonia, I think, at least twice. It wasn't pleasant, but a little penicillin, I was fine within a day or two. That's the evolution of evolution, because we're now using our minds. It's not just body. The human body hasn't really evolved for the last 50,000 years. We're pretty much the way our ancestors were 50,000 years ago. They had pretty much the same body, same brain size. They were anatomically modern humans. But what a change there's been in the last 50,000 years. We are the dominant species on the planet. We're not the hunted now. We're going to be, if anything's going on like that, we'll be the hunters. This is a tremendous change in the whole evolutionary process when it got to us. And then there's a second thing that greatly changed the evolutionary process, and that is something that C.S. Lewis said about Jesus. His very birth, his incarnation, completely changed the whole pathway of what it means to be a human being. So we're not just evolving in a physical sense. There might be some mild physical things going on. They're not completely zero, but they're close to zero. But it's the mental and cultural evolution, and in Christ, there's a new kind of human being that we can aspire to become. So, it's the evolution of evolution. There are the four challenges, you see them there. Let's go right into the first challenge now, that random mutations challenge divine design. So for centuries, especially in England, divine design was the basic way that people would say they believed in God. Even if they didn't believe in Christ, even if they didn't believe in the scriptures, even if they didn't think that God was triune, that God was a trinity, they would have a belief, and it was always that God was a designer. But along comes Darwin in 1859 with his Origin of Species, and he presents a way that it looks like it's being designed, but actually it's just random mutations. So it's not design, it's random. Now this was a threat, and this threw people into a tizzy in the late 19th century. Not everybody, there were some, and not every Christian, there were some great Christians who got on side right away and saw how evolution could actually help Christian faith. But a lot of Christians were deeply bothered by it, and they still are. Okay, so that's the threat, that's the challenge that we have to answer. So you have pattern in the evolutionary world. Now you remember the three ingredients of evolution that we did. The first was random mutations. The second was natural selection, which judges those mutations, and it's a tough judge. It says most of these don't work, they're losers, and if you do it, it's going to be your problem, and you're either going to die or you won't be able to attract a mate, and get your genes into the next generation, which is how biologists define fitness. It's getting your genes into the next generation. There's millions of ways to do that. You don't have to be the strongest and fastest and prettiest. You can do it by being the trickiest or the bacteria do it also. So there's many, many ways to do it, but you got to do it. That's part of the quest of all living things. They want to survive, and they want their offspring to survive. So, mutations, random. You can't plan them, they just happen. Natural selection judges most of them to be losers. Occasionally you get a winner, and the winner rapidly spreads through a population, and it becomes the law of the land. And the third thing is geological time. Vast, vast stretches of time. So you remember the story about sitting on the rocks above the Mississippi? Okay, well, here's another one that I don't think I did tell you. 750 million years ago, England was near the South Pole. Can you even picture that? And Japan didn't exist. It was underwater. That's what's going on. So remember, we looked at the hour hand of the clock and we said, can you see it move? And you can't. But you know it's moving. And that's what's going on in evolution. But evolution requires not just normal time. Remember, even 30,000 years, which is where you get most of the Minnesota's lakes and rivers from glaciers coming through. And the geologists don't even care about that stuff. It's too recent. They're talking about millions and billions of years. Okay, so what we have here is pattern cast. This is a beautiful plan. That's a beautiful pattern. If you have chaos, you can't live. Plants that are chaotically structured will not survive. Bees, ducks, dogs that are chaotically structured will not survive. You have to have pattern, and the pattern has to be repeatable. But again and again, what we see in the biological world is the disruption of pattern, chaos. It's actually a technical term in biology, chaos studies. There's a whole realm of a subfield in biology called chaos studies. So chaos comes in, something disrupts the system and messes it up. Everything was orderly. Something comes along and messes it up. But here's what's beautiful about the system. It doesn't spin off into total chaos. It always finds a new pattern. So you see, it goes from pattern to chaos to a new pattern. And if the new pattern is a superior pattern, the superior pattern will have more stability, and those who have it will become dominant, whether it's a plant or an animal. Are you familiar with the Fibonacci series? Okay, good. So you can see it there. If you add each number to the number before it, you will get the next number. Now you say, okay, that's kind of a fun little parlor trick. But it actually plays out everywhere you look in the biological world. It plays out in animals, and it plays out in plants. It's mathematically based. All of it is mathematically based. And if it's mathematically based, what does that remind you of? One word from the first session. Logos, thank you. Yeah, exactly. Now, you know when you're sitting in some professor's talking and asks a question, they do what I call a professorial fishing expedition. You know, you have to guess until you guess the one I want you to say. So we'll do some fishing expeditions as we go on. But that's exactly it. It's logos. That pattern is logos. That mathematics is logos. Now, what you're looking at there is the kernel of a sunflower seed. Now, it's beautiful just by looking at it. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful plant. It makes nice little things we can eat. But the order that is inside this thing is absolutely magnificent. It turns out that it's based on the Fibonacci series. So you have alternate rows that are going in different, you go clockwise, and then you go counterclockwise, and clockwise, and counterclockwise. It alternates. Now, when you alternate the rows, you can pack in twice as many seeds. If you pack in twice as many seeds, then the plant has just doubled its chances of getting its seeds into the next generation. That is a brilliant biological evolutionary strategy. But it turns out it's not just DNA that's doing it. It is DNA. But the DNA is calling forth the mathematical pattern of the Fibonacci series. It turns out that when that kernel is being formed, you see that that number there, 137.5 degrees. It's called the angle of rotation. Now, that's kind of complicated. I can show it to you if you really want to see it. But it turns out that angle of rotation is actually corresponds to the Fibonacci series. And here's what happens. Computer studies, simulated studies. If you increase the rotation of the seeds over 137.5, just a little bit over it, you don't get the alternating series. You'll just get clockwise or counterclockwise. I forget which one it is. And if you decrease it below 137.5, you won't get the other one. But if you're right at 137.5, which exactly corresponds to the Fibonacci series, you get it. So the DNA calls forth the best mathematical pattern. And that mathematical pattern is all over the place. It's in broccoli. It's in all kinds of the way trees pattern and leaf and so forth. And so what I'm trying to show you, folks, is that the biology is beautiful. And our Creator is beautiful. This is another way of looking at the Fibonacci series. You see, if you have a, you see the length of the line there. If you have a plus b over a is in proportion as a is to b, that'll give you the series. The beauty of a snail's protective cover, you see, it's right on the Fibonacci series. The Fibonacci series is a non-obvious symmetry. We love symmetry because symmetry is beautiful. The ancient Greeks thought that symmetry was the basis of beauty. It was in their theory of beauty. Now, there are obvious symmetries. For instance, if a bird only has one wing, not going to work very well for flying. If an animal, like a fox, doesn't have left-right symmetry, or if something's wrong with its right paw on the right side, it will lose its symmetry and it won't be able to run well. So symmetry is highly functional. But symmetry also comes up in us. Now here you have a rather classically beautiful human face, and it turns out that the details of the face are based on the Fibonacci series. Even beautiful human teeth turn out to be in the proportion of the Fibonacci series. Now, you sometimes will hear beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Biologists think that's false. So do mathematicians, and so do I. Now, I think there's room for personal taste. Some people prefer this kind of ice cream and others prefer that and so forth. But there is a basis that is cross-cultural, even in terms of like shoulder width to waist width, those kind of proportions. They're attractive cross-culturally. And this is part of the ways human beings become attractive is by meeting those preset biological non-obvious symmetries, like in this beautiful young lady's face. Okay, so where does the order come from? That's the question. We know there is order. Where does the order come from? And you could say, well, we just got lucky. This is nonsense. That's not science to say we just got lucky. So, and sometimes you have scientists themselves who will talk that way. But when they talk that way, they're not being scientific. They're just giving you bad philosophy or bad theology. But it's not science. Science will explain how an order comes about. But the interpretation of the science, that's critical. And that's our job. Again, not to fight the science, but to interpret it correctly. And that's what we're about tonight. Well, we know about order. And order is a big part of Catholic moral thought. You have an ordered life and a disordered life. You have order in nature, in society, and you have order within your own self. And all of us know about the disorder within our own selves, too. We're good at that. But how do we get it? That's the key. Where did the order come from? Now, one way of saying it is, well, it just came because God, in the beginning, figured out every species exactly the way God wanted it. Now there are people who hold that view, millions of them, and they are our brothers and sisters, and so we respect them, even though we may want to disagree with their point of view. But this is sometimes called creationism. It also is about what's called a young earth theory. If you take this position, you're going to be fighting against everything in contemporary science. And you will lose. And secondly, I think you'd also be fighting against something that's true. Second way to explain order. Now, well, let me say one more thing about this first position. In this first position, you've got to explain things like God becomes a kind of micromanager that designs elephants and mosquitoes and bacteria. And it's kind of a, it ends up not being very appealing or aesthetic the way we would think of God. A second way of explaining the order is what's called intelligent design. You've all heard of intelligent design, right? Or many of you have. Okay, now this theory is an important theory, and I actually know some of the people who have brought it forth. They're good folks. Now, I also think they're wrong. And it's extremely difficult to show why. But I'll show you one or two things why tonight. And if you want to know more, there's things you can read that will explain that, including my book goes into this in some detail. But again, it seems like a good theory, especially for Christians. And one of the main theorists, Michael Behe, is a Catholic with 9 kids. So, you know, he's a good guy. But here's the problem. Intelligent design says things like, well, the human eye, we're back to the human eye. Remember the eye? That it's too complicated. Everything has to be in place or the system wouldn't work. But yeah, that's true, the way the eye is right now. But think about the long, long geological history where the eye develops in small, small steps. That's the first answer to that. But in 1994, Michael Behe challenged evolutionary biologists, particularly about the first whale fossils. Now the whales, you know, were thought to have been land creatures that migrated back to the sea. So he said, okay, well, where are the fossils? You guys have this elegant little theory, but you don't have any fossils. Now it's a little unfair to demand fossils because everything doesn't fossilize. and everything doesn't get kept when it fossilizes. It has to land in just the right kind of soil at just the right time and so forth. You have to get lucky to get a fossil. So there, you're going to get millions or even billions of creatures that don't fossilize. But Behe demanded it. Well, this is the funny part of the story. In the same year that he published the article demanding it, three transitional fossils were found. At least two of them were in Pennsylvania. Now that should have awakened him. I did mention that to him in a private conversation. Well, I don't think that affects my theory. I said, oh, I think it does. Big time. You know, if you say, demand to see this proof, you get the proof, you got to adjust your thinking at that point. So there's a lot of this sort of thing. So intelligent design, there's something important about intelligent design. And let me tell you what it is that we have to have, even though we don't accept their biological theory. When God created, it had to be intelligent, and it had to be designed. So they've co-opted two terms that are absolutely essential to any Christian understanding of creation. It's got to be intelligent, it's got to be designed. But it doesn't have to be designed the way the intelligent design people are saying it has to be designed. It could be that evolution is a participation in the design. So when God created creation, that's where we live, the creation itself is creative. It itself is finding new and interesting pathways toward perfection. Now, which is a superior creation? The one that just one time, long ago, sits still, nothing changes, or the one where you actually have this development? Now, of course, I'm contending that the development fits my favorite parable, which is the parable of the talents. The same way we're called upon to grow morally and spiritually, it fits because that's the way the environment's moving. It's moving. Creation is moving. Creation is alive. And there's just something really beautiful about a creation that is alive and creative. So yes, it's pattern, but these are moving patterns and changing patterns. So it makes it way more complicated. So evolution in some ways debunks the old concept of design, but now we live in a creation that is designed to design itself. That is a magnificent creation. And if you've got a magnificent creation that can design itself, that just speaks to the glory of the Creator. You lose nothing, you actually gain something by taking this point of view. But that's what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to turn the challenge to an advantage. So this is a key move in it. Creation is creative. And by the way, you and I are part of the creativity. Every family is creative in different ways. You just never get two that are alike. Every human person is creative in different ways. Every church family is creative in different ways. Okay, two key players, famous guys. Now on your left there is Stephen Jay Gould, recently deceased, who was famous Harvard paleontologist and biologist. On your right is Simon Conway Morris, who is at Cambridge in England. Gould has this famous metaphor. Gould was an agnostic most of his life. And he wrote great books. If you ever read one of his books, you'll learn a lot of biology. It's a lot of fun. And he was just a terrific writer, but he really just didn't get the theology. So Gould said, if you replayed the tape of evolution over millions and millions or billions of years, you'd be very unlikely to ever see a human being again. So it's a famous metaphor, replay the tape. And you'd get a completely different evolution with completely different animals and completely, and probably, you wouldn't get human beings if you replayed it 1,000 times. That's Gould. But this fellow on the right, and these two did know each other, Conway Morris is still alive. And Conway Morris is a Christian. And he argued, no, that's wrong. You would get human beings. And he argued it because of that word right above his head there, convergences. This is a key term in evolution. Convergence is defined as different animals getting to the same result by completely different pathways in completely different locations. So let's go back to our old buddy, the eye. The eye, the human eye, is called a camera eye. It's different than like a fly's eye. But the human eye is in convergence with the eye of a whale, with the eye of an octopus, with an eye of the jellyfish, with the eye of a snail. All of them have found evolutionary pathways to find the camera eye. Now, why did they do that? Because it's the most efficient way of seeing. So, here's the takeaway. Evolution doesn't keep going random, random, random. It keeps going to similar pattern, pattern, pattern. Because there's only so many patterns that are going to work that'll get you what you need to survive. Similarly, there's a chemical inside fish that live in the Arctic and in the Antarctic. It's the same chemical, and it keeps their internal fluids from freezing. It's another convergence. If they didn't get to the convergence, they probably would have died, and there wouldn't have been fish there. And that the only way they're going to be fish is if they come up with a solution like that or something very much like it. All right, so, entropy is disorder. We need disorder. Why do we need disorder? Okay, take the letters of the alphabet. There's 26 of them. Suppose there was a rule that said after every A, you had to have pick the letter, a D. And after every D, you had to have an S. You could build up the rules very, very strictly where it had to be a certain way. But if you did that, you would end up with what's called frozen order. And you wouldn't get the rich vocabulary we actually have. We can do hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words, and you can think new thoughts with new words all the time. But you need two things. You need an alphabet that's orderly. We've got it. And then you need to be able to disassemble your words, to recreate them and recombine them. So again, it's pattern, chaos, pattern. And that's what we get in the evolutionary world. That's what entropy is. Entropy is the disorder. You remember the picture of that young boy with the completely disordered, disheveled room? Okay, that's entropy. It's easier to get disorder than it is to get order. But we have to have some disorder, disturbing though it will be, in order to get to the new pattern, the new and superior pattern. Now there's a big dispute among biologists about progress, but there really shouldn't be. And for any Christian who looks at evolution and adopts it, progress is a must. You can say, fine, the whole thing starts 3.45 billion years ago with single-celled organisms. And then it evolves into pond scum and eventually into flies and fish and sharks and horses, and then we finally show up. You gotta call that progress. Now, biologists all agree that there are trends, but they really, a lot of them hate the idea of progress. Stephen Jay Gould hated the notion of progress. He called it a noxious idea. But that's his atheism talking. That's not his biology talking. There clearly have been trends. There clearly has been progress, especially if you think it's a good idea to have human beings. But we have to be here. For all our faults, what would creation be without folks like us? They don't have to look like us, but they have to be able to know God and love God. They have to be able to know each other and love each other. Now, if you can go from single-celled bacteria to us guys in that sense, I'm saying hallelujah. That's progress. And that shows a purpose in the overall process. And look at what's developed. Vision, hearing, great sense of smell, olfaction, echolocation, like in a bat. A bat worked out through the evolutionary process basically what our sonar does when it's trying to locate submarines. And radar. But remember, these sonar and radar were worked out during times of conflict. Conflict presses us. We don't like conflict. I don't like conflict. But it pushes us to see new things, to do new things. So it goes pattern, chaos, pattern. Okay, let's take a break, and when you come back, we'll do part two, which is the second challenge, that natural selection questions whether God loves all. I have an answer for that one too.
Might just leave it.
Leave it on during break.